All right, hello, and happy Wednesday afternoon. It's very quiet here. We had snow last night, and snow always seems to make things quieter. For one, I suppose, you know, we have lots of construction going on here, lots of building going on here. It's been happening for about a year and a half now, and, you know, all those people aren't working because of the snow. And we also, they're putting a sidewalk behind my house. There's always been a dirt trail, but they're turning that into a paved trail. But they're not working today because of the snow, so so it's very, very quiet here. No construction, no road work. And I think the snow muffles other sounds, too. So, Cheryl said snow slows things down, makes everything seem so still. Yeah, that's what we're experiencing. So what I'm going to do is start with a song. This song is by a Christian group called One by One. And that's, let me type that in the room because it's really a cool name. It's W-O-N by O-N-E, one by one. And, you know, what that really reminds me of is, you know, that my heart is one, W-O-N by the truth, one, O-N-E, right? So that's the name of this particular band, One by One. And the name of this particular song is called Why Walk When You Can Fly.
In this world, there's a whole lot of trouble. In this world, there's a whole lot of pain. In this world, there's a whole lot of trouble, but a whole lot of ground to gain. Why take when you could be given? Why watch as the world goes by? It's a hard enough life to be living. Why walk when you can fly?
Why walk when you can fly? Oh. Why walk when you can fly? Why walk when you can fly? Oh, oh, why?
In this world there's a whole lot of sorrow. In this world there's a whole lot of shame. In this world there's a whole lot of sorrow, but a whole lot of ground to gain. When you spend your whole life wishing, watching and wondering why, it's a long enough life to be living. Why walk when you can fly?
Why walk when you can fly?
A whole lot of pain. In this world, you've a soul for a compass and a heart for a pair of wings. Now there's a star on the far horizon, rising bright in an azure sky. But for the rest of the time that you're given,
why walk when you can fly? Why walk when you can fly?
When I die, hallelujah, by and by,
why walk when you can fly?
There we go. So it feels like forever since I taught the Guiding Light. I think it's been since before the fall retreat. Even after the fall retreat, there was a week that I missed because I needed to take Jacqueline to the airport. So it's been, you know, 2 or 3 weeks since I've been here. And I opened my book that I'm teaching from, which is The Spiritual Teaching of Ramana Maharshi. And we're in the second section called Spiritual Instruction. And although I could remember teaching about this topic, which is the guru, you know, what is the guru? I couldn't remember exactly where I left off. I think I might be ready for question number 8. But for anybody listening to the audios, if you happen to have just listened to the previous audio and I'm doing some repetition, forgive me, because it's just so hard to remember where I left off. But because I think that it's question number 8 that I'm supposed to begin on, that's where I am going to begin. Let me just look at 7, make sure I feel like I read that. Yeah, I do feel like I read 7, so I'm going to start with number 8. So question number 8, again, all of these questions right now are about the guru. Question number 8 then says, how then did some great persons attain knowledge without a guru? So what's been happening, again, since it's been a long time since I've been here, is we have been listening to a questioner, or maybe it's a selection of questioners, but they're all asking Ramana Maharshi about the guru. And Ramana Maharshi seems to be saying that a guru is needed. But Ramana Maharshi was also saying that the guru, let me find this definition, he defined what a guru is. That the guru is steady abidance in the self, looking at all with an equal eye, unshakable courage at all times, in all places and circumstances, etc. So that was the definition of a real teacher, or of a real teacher of the Sadguru. Again, steady, abiding in the self, looking at all with an equal eye, unshakable courage at all times, in all places and circumstances, etc. So what that would mean is that a lot of humans, even humans who have a genuine role of spiritual teaching now, they still don't really meet the requirements of guru. There may be some. There may be some that do meet those requirements, but they might be hard to find. I would venture to guess that the vast majority of spiritual teachers would not meet these requirements. I don't meet these requirements. So the question becomes then, what do I do? Do I spend my whole life running around trying to find a guru who does meet these requirements? Or is it possible that there's a guru that's available to me right now, all the time, that I can turn to in earnestness whenever I want? And at least my feeling is, my answer is that I do have such a guru. And that guru lives within. You know, and that's obviously a symbol, lives within. But, you know, I there is a part of me, you know, which we may call inner intuition, we may call the Holy Spirit, we may call the inner guru. But there is a part of me that consistently meets these requirements. There's a part of me that is steady abidance in the self, looking at all with equal eye, unshakable courage at all times, in all places and circumstances. And I am able to turn my attention to that. So when I was teaching last time, although Ramana Maharshi continued to talk about the guru, and it appeared he was really talking about the need for an outer guru, I kept reinterpreting the answers to be the inner guru. In fact, one of the questions I kept asking the last time I taught was something like, do you want to spend your whole life running around trying to find this perfect guru, or do you just want to turn within? Right? It seems to me that's much more practical and effective to just turn within and find the genuine guru that's right here all the time. So that kind of leads up to what we talked about last time, whenever last time was. And question number 8 then, after this discussion about the need for a guru, and again, Ramana Maharshi was really talking about an external guru in spite of my reinterpretation. That leads up to number 8. How then did some great persons attain knowledge without a guru? Because again, Ramana Maharshi has been talking about how important a guru is. And so the questioner is like, well, some people did it without a guru. In fact, Ramana himself did it without a guru, right? So how then did some great persons attain knowledge without a guru? And this is Ramana Maharshi's answer. To a few, I'm sorry, my mouth doesn't seem to be working very well today, but I haven't been talking much today, so it probably just hasn't been exercised. To a few mature persons, the Lord shines as the light of knowledge and imparts awareness of the truth. So that's Ramana Maharshi's answer. The question again, how then did some great persons attain knowledge without a guru? Answer, to a few mature persons, the Lord shines as the light of knowledge and imparts awareness of the truth. So what I really feel that they are talking about here is what we would call spontaneous awakenings. And in fact, that's really what happened to Ramana Maharshi, right? Ramana Maharshi was either 16 or 17. He was, you know, one age or the other. I really don't remember which. I think some things I've read say 16 and some things I've read say 17. So so I say 16 or 17. He was 16 or 17 years old when an experience came upon him where he thought he was going to die. Some people might call it a panic attack. He was doing his homework at the time. He was alone, I think, in the upper room at his uncle's house. But instead of calling for help, which a lot of people would do if they thought they were going to die, Ramana Maharshi decided he needed to solve this now for himself. And what he really meant by that was he had to discover what dies and what lives. You know, what dies and what lives. That's what he went in to discover. And he went through this experience of looking to see what dies and what lives. And he decided that the body dies, but the spirit lives. And that he is the spirit. That he is not the body, that he is the spirit. And then after that point, he became what he calls very interested in the self, the true self. And in fact, he spent the next many years, and again, I don't remember exactly how many years, could be 11, could be 17, could be somewhere in between. But he spent the next many years in silence, in meditation, focusing attention on the self, what we would call literally awareness, watching awareness. And this was the only thing he had interest in. You know, some people say that Ramana Maharshi woke up that day when he made the decision that he was not the body, he was the spirit. I don't know that for sure. I don't know that there wasn't a shift that day, but sometimes I wonder if the true awakening, which we would call Manonasa, didn't occur in those years afterwards when he sat in awareness, watching awareness meditation all of the time. And it kind of reminds me of Jesus. You know, a lot of people say that Jesus woke up in the desert in the 40 days and 40 nights, but I don't think that's true either. I think there may have been a definite shift there, but it appears that the final awakening occurred that night in the Garden of Gethsemane, which would have been 3 years later. But regardless of whether Ramana Maharshi woke up at age 16 or 17 or whether that was just the beginning of the awakening, and that the awakening actually occurred some time later while sitting in a cave, he did it without a guru. Maybe. Maybe. And the maybe is coming from a quote that I can't perfectly quote for you, but I remember the gist of it. It's a quote by Ramana Maharshi where he refers to the inner awareness as the guru. So let's just go with that theory for a moment. If the inner awareness is the guru, then it is possible, and I highlight the word possible because, again, I don't know, and the theory that I am sharing here, I have never heard anyone else share, right? But it's possible that what really happened when he was 16 or 17 years old is he woke up to the realization of something other than the person and something other than the body. And a keen interest in that also awoke in him. A keen interest in that. And so then all he wanted to do was pay attention to that. He had no interest in the world anymore. And he felt called to Arunachala, and he went to Arunachala, first sitting in the temple, then in a cave on Arunachala, then another cave in Arunachala. But he went to Arunachala. He completely dropped out of, you know, modern day life. And he closed his eyes and he spent all of his time giving his attention to that which he now had this keen desire to give attention to. And in those years, as he just sat doing nothing but giving attention to that, that was his guru. Anything else that was left that needed to fall away, fell away in the light of that awareness, watching awareness. Any wisdom that was to be imparted was imparted through that time of awareness, watching awareness. Right? Again, this is just a theory. But it's what I perceive as a helpful theory. Because if there's any truth to it, I can follow in that same direction. I can't follow in the direction of a spontaneous full awakening, a spontaneous manonessa. You know, again, it's possible that it really was just a spontaneous shift that happened rather than manonessa, and that manonessa, the final end of the ego, occurred later, right? But there is nothing that I can do to spur a spontaneous manonessa. You know, I could sit down and try to do high school homework, which is what Ramana Maharshi was doing, and it's not going to work, right? But if the true guru is the inner awareness, which Ramana Maharshi has said, I can sit and give my attention to that guru, kind of sit at the feet of that guru, right, which is tension within. I can sit at the feet of that guru. And then, you know, I suppose everything else would happen out of that. But see, that's something I can do. I can sit at the feet of awareness, in awareness watching, awareness meditation, or again, my specific form that I feel I'm more suited to is the loving consciousness meditation. So again, the question here was, how then did some great persons attain knowledge without a guru? And he's answering, to a few mature persons, the Lord shines as the light of knowledge and imparts awareness of truth. So it seems that he's saying, sometimes it just happens. Right? The next question, what is the end of devotion and the path of... And now here's a word I don't know, so we'll look this up in the back. It's Siddhanta, Siddhanta. So let me turn to the glossary. Well, it's not here in the glossary. The closest word to it, though I don't think it's related, is siddhi, which is accomplishment or supernatural power. But siddhanta is not in the glossary. So we've got all the time in the world, so I'm going to start the internet. And I'm going to type that word in and see what we get. The way the word is spelt is S-I-D-D-H-A-N-T-A. So I'm typing that in, S-I-D-D-H-A-N-T-A. And let's see what we get. Okay, here's Wikipedia. Wikipedia says it is a Sanskrit term denoting the established and accepted view of any particular school within Indian philosophy. So it would be kind of like a graduation, I guess, you know. Let's see. It's a Sanskrit term denoting the established and accepted view of any particular school within Indian philosophy. You know, it could be called an opinion, a doctrine, a dogma. So in this sentence, when he says, what's the end of devotion or the end of the path of Indian philosophy, of spiritual teaching of a particular religion? That's what he's saying. It's not graduation. Cut that comment. So the question is, what is the end of devotion? And what is the end of my religious education or my spiritual education? Right? That's really, I think, what this question means. So here's Ramana Maharshi's answer. It is to learn the truth that all one's actions performed with unselfish devotion, with the aid of the three purified instruments, body, speech, and mind, in the capacity of the servant of the Lord, becomes the Lord's actions. And to stand forth free from the sense of I and mind. This is also the truth of what the, whatever that word is, what the Siddhantas call supreme devotion or living in the service of God. So again, what the question is what is the end of my devotion, right? And this would be an I, right? An I, you know, my devotion to God. What is the end of my devotion to God and the end of my religious or spiritual education? And basically what Ramana Maharshi is saying is it's being free of the sense of I. So another way that we could really see that is, as long as there is still a sense of I, a sense of me, I need to be continuing with my devotion and with my religious or spiritual education. Now, of course, there could be religious and spiritual education that is not helpful, right? So there's some discernment there. But until the sense of I, until we are free of the sense of I and mine, we're to continue to be devoted to the spiritual path. That's what I see as the answer to this question. The next question is, and this is, it sounds similar, but I think to a Hindu person it would be different. Because the first question is, what is the end of devotion and the path of religious education? This one is, what is the end of the path of knowledge or Vedanta? And although I've known this before, I have forgotten. So I'm going to pull up. Let's see, what can I pull up? I am going to pull up a document that I wrote once upon a time, because I have actually covered this in my document. I'm going to pull up a definition I wrote of what the path of knowledge is. So let me find that. So nice that it's a quiet day and we have time for all of this. The document that I'm actually pulling up is the Ramana Maharshi course that I wrote for the Awakening Together Minister Preparation Program, which actually uses the book we're in right now as the textbook. And so, you know, I looked up some of this stuff and I put it in the workbook. Okay, so according to this, the path of knowledge is self-inquiry, asking, who am I? That is the path of knowledge. So you can see that the path of knowledge then is most definitely different from the path of devotion, which is really surrendering to a god or the inner teacher. And the path of religious studies, which is an outward learning way, this is the path of inquiry, the path of knowledge, right? Who am I? So, what is the end of the path of knowledge, or Vedanta? And Ramana Maharshi answers, it is to know the truth that the I is not different from the Lord, and to be free from the feeling of being the doer. So that's an interesting question too, because, I mean, an interesting answer too, because the question basically is, what is the end of the inquiry, who am I? What is the end of the inquiry, who am I? And he says the answer is to know that the I is not different from the Lord. Right? So it's to realize yourself way beyond the person. To realize yourself as the Absolute. When you realize yourself as the Absolute, when you know, not intellectually, but that is your direct experience, that you are the Absolute, then there's no more need for who am I. Until that time, it's to be continued. And he also gives another hint here. He said it is to know the truth that the I is not different from the Lord, and to be free from the feeling of being the doer. Right? Free from the feeling of being the I, which is a body and a mind in the world that's doing stuff. Right? So when you're free of the feeling that you're I is referring to a mind and a body in the world doing stuff. And instead you see I as the absolute stillness that he's calling the Lord. When that point is reached, then you are done with the question, who am I? So he's asked about the path of devotion or religious studies. And he's asked about the path of self-inquiry. So the questioner's next question is, how can it be said that the end of both of these paths is the same? Ramana Maharshi answers, whatever the means, the destruction of the sense of I and mine is the goal. And as these are interdependent, the destruction of either of them causes the destruction of the other. Therefore, in order to achieve that state of silence, which is beyond thought and word, either the path of knowledge, which removes the sense of I, or the path of devotion, which removes the sense of mine, will suffice. So there is no doubt that the end of the paths of devotion and knowledge is one and the same. And then there's a note. I'm not sure if the note is from Ramana Maharshi or from the man who wrote this down. It doesn't clarify. But it says, note, So long as the I exists, it is necessary to accept the Lord also. If anyone wishes to regain easily the supreme state of identity now lost to him, it is only proper that he should accept this conclusion. So the path of devotion, bhakti, is a path of loving surrender. And it's really for someone who is rather heart-centered. You know, I mentioned to you all that although I call them both awareness, watching, awareness, that really my particular slant of awareness, watching, awareness is loving consciousness. When I practice just awareness, watching, awareness, without the loving consciousness method, when I practice just awareness, watching, awareness, it feels a bit dry to me. It's challenging to keep my attention with the awareness. My attention wants to go back to the thinking. It's almost like there's no help in practicing awareness, watching awareness, if I'm practicing that form. But when I practice loving consciousness, which to me is still awareness, watching awareness, but you add the feelings of love and appreciation and even worship to it, that seems to have some glue in it for me, where I'm able to stay with awareness, watching awareness, better and longer without being distracted. So that probably means that I'm a person of the heart. Other individuals are what we would call persons of the mind. And for them, the love and loving consciousness may even seem foolish. They're much more attracted to the pure awareness, watching, awareness practice. And Ramana Maharshi does really teach that spiritual aspirants tend to be in one category or the other. They tend to be in the heart-centered category or the head-centered category, and that it really is best to select the practices that work for you based on the category that you're in. You know, you shouldn't think that, you know, because Regina loves loving consciousness, I should love loving consciousness, because maybe you're head-centered, you know. Or because Michael talks about awareness, watching awareness more, that you should do awareness, watching awareness, because maybe you're more heart-centered and the loving consciousness method will work best. You know, you need to find your own way. Well, Ramana Maharshi has always seemed to teach that people do kind of fall into one category or the other. And he refers to devotion as the path for the heart-centered person. Devotion is loving a god. Could be any god. But it's all about the loving. You get lost in the loving. You know, the entire Sufi religion is based on this, getting lost in the loving. You know, you go so deep into the loving that you disappear in the loving. And a part of the loving or the devotion, and this is also true of the Sufi religion, a part of the loving or the devotion is that you become so committed to your God that all of your acts, A-C-T-S, right, all of your acts belong to him or her or it. You have nothing of your own. You surrender completely. You give your entire life to your God, your entire body to your God, your entire mind to your God, your entire soul to your God, right? You give everything to your God and you get lost in the loving of your God. And so what Ramana Maharshi is saying is that if you're the heart-centered type, this path of devotion, what it really gets rid of is the mine. Because there's not my life, there's not my works, there's not my ideas. You've surrendered all of the my, you've given everything to your God, and you live only for your God. so it gets rid of the mine. And he says, when you get rid of the mine, when you really thoroughly go deep into that path of devotion and you get rid of the mine, the I will die also, because they are connected. After all, what has a mine but an I? So go deep enough into the love of your God, and the false self will die. He says that is one path. But again, not everyone is heart-centered. Not everyone has that devotional leaning. And so for the people that are more mind-centered, he recommends more the more mental, who am I type of investigation. Also, that would join up with awareness, watching, awareness, meditation. And what happens by looking for the I, and I listened to a great audio by Adya Shanti yesterday about this, which eventually I will make an assignment in the Gentle Healing Group. He must have been more mind-centered. He really talked about how he was looking for the I, and just couldn't find it. But when you go about looking for the I, where's that I? and can't find it, eventually something happens, and the idea of an I disappears. So two different paths that get to the same destination, the end of the false self. And, you know, a lot of people really teach that Ramana Maharshi taught the path of knowledge, the who am I, and there's no doubt that Ramana Maharshi taught that. But what a lot of people don't notice is that he also taught the path of devotion for the individuals that he felt were suited to that path of devotion. Personally, I'm going to take a drink of water, then I'll continue talking. I was really grateful to Michael Langford when he developed How to Live a Life That Knows Only Love, which is the book all about loving consciousness. What happened was at that time, I don't remember how long we had been talking, but we were talking through email. And I was trying to learn to meditate. I was not yet meditating. And I was having so much trouble. I mean, I would fall asleep, get bored, fall asleep. I mean, I was going nowhere with it. And I could go back and look for that email, but I won't take that time now because it's not important, but I'm certain that I still have it. Michael sent me a couple of emails recommending a new or a different meditation for me. This meditation was mentioned briefly in one or two paragraphs in The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss, but he did not dedicate chapters to it. Like, he had dedicated a chapter or two to awareness, watching, awareness, and he had dedicated a chapter to the abandoned release method, but he had not dedicated a chapter, only a couple of paragraphs, to this form of meditation. And that was the loving consciousness meditation. So he wrote to me and he recommended that, and he sent me a couple of emails with some instructions. And I tried it, and for the first time ever, I actually meditated. And it was easy. And I really think that it was seeing that in me that prompted him to write the book, because it was only about a month. You know, I mean, right then he started writing the book, and it was like a month later that he had it ready and published it. So I really feel that watching the difference between me struggling with awareness, watching, awareness, and then me just, you know, taking like a fish to water to loving consciousness, led him to go ahead and devote an entire book to the loving consciousness method. Maybe, and hear the giant maybe in the sentence, maybe he had not given much attention to the loving consciousness method before, other than brief mention, because he is, or was, as a person, more head-centered. And then he ran across me as a student who was more heart-centered. right? And that led him to then provide greater information on this tool that's for the more heart-centered person. I think it's perfect for us to really recognize what works best for us. You know, there are a lot of tools that are provided for us. And rather than thinking that I should be able to take to a certain tool, even though I'm not, to try, you know, a few different methods and a few different tools and find out which one really works for me, that's what we need to be willing to do. We need to have that freedom within ourselves. Nobody else takes that freedom away from us. We take that freedom away from us. We need to have that freedom within ourselves to recognize, this is the form that works for me. This is the tool that works for me. And then use it. Now, again, we have this note. We have Ramana Maharshi saying that the end of the path of devotion and the end of the path of knowledge is the same end, right? It's the end of the false self. So either path is good, whichever path suits you. One path is not superior to the other. But then we have this note. And again, we don't know for sure where this note comes from. It could come from Ramana Maharshi. Hopefully it does. It says note. Maybe he just said this at another time, and the person who put the book together thought it fit good here, so he stuck it in as a note, right? But it says, so long as the I exists, it is necessary to accept the Lord also. If anyone wishes to regain easily the supreme state of identity now lost to him, it is only proper that he should accept this conclusion. Now, I don't read that as meaning that you need to have a God that you are devoted to. Because again, the path of devotion is for the heart-centered people, and not everyone is heart-centered. I take this as meaning you have to accept there's something greater than you as you perceive yourself now, right? Greater than the person, greater than the body, greater than the ego, greater than the intellect. You have to accept that there's something greater than you. And I do think that's very important because I have observed during my years on the spiritual path that, you know, people read things like, you know, we're all already awake. And then what adopts that as I'm awake, I'm already awake, is the ego. You know, if there's no acceptance that there's something beyond me, then I'm not looking for or reaching for anything beyond me. I just shift my ideas about what I am. I shift my ideas about what I am. You know, even if you're practicing something like awareness, watching awareness, Michael Langford writes in his book, The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss, that, you know, you're going to be focusing on the awareness that wakes up in the morning and goes to bed at night. But then later in his book, he makes it clear that that awareness that appears to wake up in the morning and go to bed at night really isn't the same thing as divine awareness. And to me, that's a very, very important point. And Nisargadatta Maharaj makes the same point. Because if I really just focus on this awareness that I have as a human that appears to wake up in the morning and go to bed at night and just focus on it all the time and then get this idea in my head, that's it, that's it, that's it, well, then I just think that my normal everyday awareness is the absolute. And it's not. This everyday awareness is more like the sunbeam, but it's not the sun. The sun is greater than the sunbeam. Divine awareness is greater than this everyday human awareness. We need to realize that there is an experience that is so phenomenally different from our current experience that we can't even imagine it. We can't even begin to imagine it. But that's the experience of awakening. That's the experience that we are working towards. We're working towards something that is greater than what we currently perceive ourselves to be, what we currently see as our awareness, what we currently see as our way of experiencing, seeing the world. It's something greater than. And if we don't have that idea that it's something greater than, the ego can just get us at some point to adopt the idea of, oh, I'm already here, right? Oh, I'm already here when nothing has changed. So I think that that's what this note is referring to. It's not that you have to be on the devotional path, because it's just not going to work if you're head-centered, but it's that you have to understand there's something greater than you as you perceive yourself now. So long as the I exists, it is necessary to accept the Lord also. That would be the something greater than you. If anyone wishes to regain easily the supreme state of identity, right? If you want to gain that supreme state of identity, which would be different than your current identity. If anyone wishes to regain easily the supreme state of identity, which is now lost to him, this says. It is now lost to him. It is only proper that he should accept this conclusion, that there's something greater than him. That leads to the last question in this particular section. The last question is, what is the mark of the ego? The answer. The individual soul of the form of I is the ego. The capital S self, which is of the nature of intelligence, has no sense of I. Nor does the insentient body possess a sense of I. The mysterious appearance of a delusive ego between the intelligent and the insentient being, the root cause of all these troubles, upon its destruction by whatever means, that which really exists will be seen as it is. This is called liberation. Now, insentient, I had to look that word up. Actually, hold on 1 second. I got to take my boots off. My body just said, I have snow boots on, and my body just said, oh my goodness, these snow boots are starting to feel confining. So I'm going to rip them off. Okay, snow boots are off. and my toes are very happy, by the way. They're very happy to be out of those snow boots. They've been in those snow boots since 8:30 this morning, and they're happy. All right. I had to look up insentient because I didn't know what it was. And insentient is something that does not, that's the correct word, does not have its own consciousness. So so Ramana Maharshi is really saying that the body does not have its own consciousness. The body is just a thing, you know, and the body by itself does not think I. So that means that whenever we have the idea that we're identified with the body, you know, like A Course in Miracles is always saying, I am not a body, I am free, I am still as God created me. The reason the Course says that, I am not a body, is because there's this idea that I am, right? And so the Course is trying to undo that idea. But what Ramana Maharshi is saying is, it's not the body that has that idea. The body doesn't have the idea, I'm the body. It's the ego that has that idea. He's literally distinguishing between the body, which is just a neutral appearance, and the ego. It's the ego that says, I am a body, not the body. So he says, when the question is asked, what is the mark of the ego? The first answer that he gives is the individual soul of the form of I is the ego. He doesn't say body. Soul. Now, if you look up the word soul in the dictionary, you'll find that the word soul has a lot of different definitions. And in fact, one of those definitions would be the body, believe it or not. But he's made it clear he's not talking about the body. So the individual soul may sometimes believe it's in a body and may sometimes have the idea I am a body, but the individual soul doesn't have to be in a body. For example, let's say that somebody is having surgery, and during surgery they have a near-death experience, right? The body, the heart stops in the body for a time, and you know the body appears dead, and they're trying to bring the person back. And during this time, the person feels that they rise above the body. They're there near the ceiling in the operating room, looking down, and they see, you know, the doctors and the nurses working on them, trying to revive them. You know, maybe they even see beyond them a light, a tunnel of light, and they have this idea that they want to go into the tunnel, and then there's just this feeling that no, they're supposed to go back into the body. And next thing they know, they're back in the body. That is the ego. Because when they tell that story, there's still an I. I was above my body. There's still an identification with that me sense, even though it wasn't in a body, right? So Ramana Maharshi says, the individual soul of the form of I is the ego. That would also be the one that reincarnates. Right, if you go to some kind of a hypnotist or something, and you have some type of a regression therapy where you're able to remember your past lives, you know, you say, I was a man in this life, and I was a woman in this life, and I was Chinese in this life, but the I that was the man and the woman and, you know, the different races, that's the ego. Oh, yeah. Cindy is saying it's interesting because one of the Buddhist prayers refers to may all sentient beings. It does not say may everybody. Yeah. So that I is the ego. So the ego is beyond the body. It may sometimes appear to be identified with a particular body, like right now in this lifetime, you know, we're each identified with our particular body. But the ego actually outlasts the body. The ego, you know, if the theory of reincarnation is true, may have the experience of being identified to many, 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 many bodies, maybe even thousands of bodies. It becomes attached to a body for a lifetime, and then it becomes attached to another body, and then another body, right? So the ego is longer lasting than a body. The individual soul of the form of I is the ego. And then after answering that question, he talks about the true self. He says the true self, which is the nature of intelligence, has no sense of I. The true self, which is the nature of intelligence, has no sense of I. So whenever there's that sense of an I, of a me, that's the ego. And then he says, nor does the insentient body possess a sense of I, right? The body doesn't have that sense. The mysterious appearance of a delusive ego between the intelligent and the insentient being, the root cause of all these troubles. I'm going to look up the word delusive. You guys are going to find out just how I don't want to say unintelligent, but you know, I don't know all this stuff, but it's not that I'm unintelligent. It just means that I know all this stuff. Okay, delusive is giving a false or misleading impression. Well, you know what I was thinking about? You know Jed Clampett? You guys remember Beverly Hillbillies? You know, Jed Clampett was not educated, right? But I definitely would say that he was intelligent. So where I'm lacking maybe sometimes is some education. I don't know what some of these words mean. But that doesn't mean I'm not intelligent, right? But I don't know every word in our dictionary by far. Not anywhere near that. So delusive again means giving a false or misleading impression. So if we look at this sentence again, the mysterious appearance of a delusive ego. So the mysterious appearance of the misleading idea of me. The mysterious appearance of a delusive ego between the intelligent, which would be the true self, and the insentient, which would be the body. And I love the way he calls this mysterious. You know, he's not in this sentence saying, hey, I know all about how this ego got developed. He's not saying that. He's saying, you know, it's mysterious. It's kind of mysterious how the true self, you know, how between the true self and this insentient body, this idea of me developed. That's mysterious. We don't really know how that came about. Right? But somewhere between the true self and the insentient body, neither of which are this sense of me, a sense of me which is very deceiving because it's not true, has developed. The mysterious appearance of a delusive ego between the intelligent and the insentient being, right? And then he says that it's the root cause of all troubles. This mysterious delusive ego, this mysterious, misleading sense of me is the root of all troubles. Then he says, upon its destruction, by whatever means. Right, because the guy's been asking about two different spiritual paths. And Ramana Maharshi was like, doesn't matter how this thing ends, whatever means causes the sense of me to end, right? Upon its destruction by whatever means, then that which really exists will be seen as it is. That's when you know what's greater than you. When the sense of me ends, then you know the greater. It's not that the sense of me is the greater, and all you have to do is start walking around saying, I'm awake, I'm awake, I'm awake. I'm aware of awareness, I'm aware of awareness, I'm aware of awareness. It's not the me is the cause of all the troubles, even including the misunderstanding about what you are. When the me ends, then you know what's greater, and you know yourself as that. You know yourself as that Lord, as that which is greater, but you have no sense of me. And he says, this is called liberation. So, you know, it's a pretty clear teaching. To me, it's pretty clear. Of course, there's still lots of people out there with a sense of me walking around saying, I'm awake. It's also very clear to me that I don't really know what this is talking about. I mean, it's clear to me that what I think I am needs to end, but I cannot tell you what that experience will be when what I think I am ends. What is clear to me is that this has to end, and then I will know. That's what's clear to me. And again, that then kind of gives me my marching orders, because remember, he said that when this delusive ego ends, whenever it's destroyed by whatever means, so what that means is, to me, is that I just need to find the means that genuinely feels like it's helpful to me. It's up to me to feel within myself and follow that path that feels right for me towards the ending of the me. And that, again, is why I've set aside these days of solitude, which starts this week, this Friday. I'm very excited. because that's what feels very, very right to me right now. And that concludes the second section of this book, which is called Spiritual Instruction. So next week, we'll start the third section of this book, which is called Practice. And so that's it for me today. I'm going to release the mic, and it's been great hanging out with y'all. I really do enjoy having y'all come here and spend time with me. Thank you. Bye.